This evening, I thought I'd talk a little bit about mindfulness, because it's a central feature to the Buddhist teachings, and the majority of people in the West who are interested in Buddhism are interested in the element of the meditation aspect and the kind of mental development. And the development of mindfulness, the use of mindfulness, is a phrase that comes up over and over again. But it's usually expressed in a little Pali lesson for you. The word that's used for mindfulness is sati. But it's actually rarely used. The word sati is actually rarely used in the scriptures. When the Buddha taught about mindfulness, he rarely used sati on its own. It rarely stands alone in the Pali Canon. It's coupled with another word called sampajanya. Sampajanya means clear comprehension. Aha, the picture is getting bigger. Mindfulness and clear comprehension. So that usually when what we're talking about mindfulness, what the Buddha is referring to is mindfulness and clear comprehension as a complete aspect. So that the sense of, because usually what happens when we talk about mindfulness, or what we assume, is this, you know, attention on an object, like trying to be mindful of the breath, or trying to be mindful of what we're doing, and sometimes we can actually be very mindful, but are we actually clearly comprehending anything? That's a good question. So that this quality of clear comprehension is a necessary element. If there's going to be any wisdom or any reflective insight, there has to be this quality of clear comprehension. And one of the images that, you know, that I just like to use is usually when, you know, like just to how we focus on paying attention or being mindful of something, and it's usually sort of going down on an object or looking on an object, and I think it's more important to sort of opening the sphere of awareness around something and holding things in awareness around it. That's a much, much nicer object, or another nice image. The classic illustration that my teacher Ajahn Chah used to give, the difference between mindfulness and mindfulness with clear comprehension, was a monk who was actually senior to Ajahn Chah, who was a senior teacher, and he used to come to Ajahn Chah's monastery to visit from time to time, and the way that the structure is set up for in the monastic training, that if somebody is senior to one, and they sit before you in the line, or they, if you go walk for alms round, and they walk for alms round in front, and it's a way that it's just an easy way to structure things. But Ajahn Chah said, whenever this monk came, being mindful was a big thing in his life, and he was actually quite proud of the fact of how mindful he was. And but Ajahn Chah, he was real pain in the neck to have around because of his mindfulness. He said it would be going alms round, and he'd be very mindful about how he was walking, and very sort of composed and very fixed on what he was doing, focused on what he was doing. But he wasn't really very clearly comprehending of actually where he was going, so that he'd be walking along behind him on alms round, and the lay people would be sitting there ready to put food in your bowl, and he wouldn't actually notice that the lay people were over there, and he'd start walking off, following the road off in a different direction, and sort of going out to the paddy fields or walking towards a buffalo pen. Ajahn Chah would have to be behind him, sort of, go right, go right. And he'd be very fixed, and then he'd have to check him. So that this sense of, you can be very, you know, mindful and focused on what you're doing, but not really clearly comprehending of how it's related to anything else that you're doing. And that's, in meditation has to be, how does it relate to what we're doing? How does it relate to the circumstances that we're in? How does it relate to the world around us, the people that we're in, the activities that we're engaged in? If it isn't doing that, then, you know, there's something lacking. So that this sense of mindfulness and clear comprehension working together. Because if it's not, it's just not applying the principles of Dhamma in a very coherent way. Circumstance in England where one of the lay supporters, he'd been going to the monastery for quite some time, and he'd go and he was a very serious practitioner, but one time he came to the monastery rather distressed and asking for advice as to what to do, because he was practicing his mindfulness and practicing his meditation and was creating problems for him and his family, and his wife and children were getting very upset with him all the time, and sort of asked them, well, what are you actually doing? And he goes into this description of, you know, trying to start his day mindfully and, you know, mindfully pouring his milk and his cornflakes, mindfully lifting up the spoon, and of course everybody else in the house is trying to get things done, and he's driving them crazy with his sort of attempts at what he thinks is mindfulness. And again, not clear comprehension of, you know, how do you fit in with what's going on around you? How do you clearly comprehend the situation and what needs to be done. And it was a sort of a shock to him, because he was very sincerely trying to apply the what he thought was the practice, but it's sort of very slow, very deliberate, very focused, very attentive, but again, just not smoothly harmonizing with the world and the circumstances and the people around him. So that practicing Dhamma, practicing meditation, shouldn't make you too odd. You should actually start to fit in a bit better with the world around one. So that, because there is a sense of, okay, say, the openness, what are the results of one's actions? What are the implications of one's actions? How does one relate to the people around one? One of the parameters of clear comprehension is clear comprehension of time and place. You know, the actual circumstance, the place, the sit, the people. What's appropriate, what's inappropriate, what's useful, what's not useful. And being able to adjust, being able to adapt. That's one of the, one of the trainings in a monastery, and particularly how Ajahn Chah used to train people, would be shifting, not letting things get too settled into routines, so that you had to learn how to adapt, and you'd change the routine. Have to get things done very quickly sometimes. You'd have to get things done slowly sometimes. You'd have to work together sometimes. You have to work on your own sometimes. So that there's really learning how to apply the mindfulness to different circumstances, to really recognize time and place, because there's there's a certain longing for security and certainty in the human mind that tends to sort of rigidify things or set things up in patterns which are one can be sure of. And one of the things you couldn't be sure of at Ajahn Chah's monastery was what was actually going to happen next. It was never quite a sure thing. Some of that I don't dare even introduce into the West. I mean, people go crazy. They can't deal with. Like sometimes, you know, starting a sitting and not actually knowing when it's going to stop. It might last for 20 minutes. It might last for 3 hours. Or starting chanting and not really knowing what actual chanting you're going to be doing. But that ability to just go with the flow and pay attention to clearly comprehending what's appropriate, how to fit into a situation, how to deal with the circumstances that one's faced with in the moment, a very important part of mindfulness. And again, the sense of mindfulness, the clear comprehension is the element of, say, the reflective capacity working in conjunction with mindfulness, the wisdom element. Because mindfulness isn't really complete without wisdom functioning. If it's just and it's interesting to pay attention to, say, like in the kind of like the the psychological analysis of mindfulness in accordance with what, say, in the say the five aggregates of being, a body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. You know, where does mindfulness lie within that? And mindfulness is a mental formation, a sankhara. And the distinguishing characteristic of a mental formation is the quality of intention or volition. And it isn't just a passive quality of awareness. There's an intentional volition, an intentional application of mind on it, for it to be mindfulness. If it's sort of like a passive awareness, there might be some sort of awareness there, but it's not really, you know, the mindfulness is really, it has to have a full intention. There has to be full awareness. There has to be this quality of the application. So that this sense of for mindfulness to be complete in terms of a Buddhist perspective, there is this element of clear comprehension, wisdom, functioning. The time and place is part of the sense of what clear comprehension revolves around. Clear comprehension of one's own capabilities. There's a by recognizing, say, what's appropriate for oneself, what's inappropriate for oneself, what's within one's realm of capability, what isn't. That plays a large part in clear comprehension, because we can very easily come from a place of ideals of how we think we should be, rather than clearly comprehending what's appropriate for us. What are we actually capable of doing? Not necessarily in a fixed way. So, like, right in this moment, what am I capable of? Maybe yesterday I could handle so much. Today, really, not that much. To have that clear comprehension, right? Because usually what happens is we come from an ideal of what we think we should or what we think we can't, and we're not really clearly comprehending what we're actually capable of, what's appropriate for us. Just in the realm of and just like in sitting meditation, you know, what is, when do we shift our posture? And when do we sort of grit our teeth and continue to make ourselves miserable? Or when do we use it as a, or even if it is, say, if it is uncomfortable, how do we clearly comprehend what is what we're capable of in using it as a means of furthering our, say, developing a patience or developing of skills of dealing with difficulty? And when do we set it aside? You know, those are really important issues, because we tend so much to come from what we think we should do and how we should be, and then we get frustrated and caught up because I can't do something, or set up the self-image is getting in the way so much. So that clear comprehension is sort of going through that self-image and coming from a place of, oh, what's appropriate, what's useful, what is. And this is where, you know, really being grounded in, say, what's the purpose of the teachings? And you know, the purpose is always sort of suffering, end of suffering. You know, those, you're using, you know, seeing suffering and paying attention to where is the end of suffering? Where is the cessation of suffering? So then bringing it back to that quality of practical application and the experiential rather than the idealized form of what we should be getting or should be becoming. There's another aspect of clear comprehension is being able to clearly comprehend when one is deluded or when one isn't deluded. And that's much more difficult because, of course, the function of delusion is to delude. And but also that's where one uses the experiential level of paying attention to, you know, am I creating more suffering, or am I inclining towards as an ending of suffering? So that by paying attention to that, say on the experiential level, it cuts through the tendency to delusion. So that that clear comprehension of moment-to-moment experience is just very helpful. And then using different tools to help support that. That's why say at the beginning of the meditation, I talked about, you know, really paying attention to the body. The body is very helpful for getting anchored, getting awareness established, which has a parameter, a foundation, a measuring stick, helps one to have something solid to measure with, so that the this sense of paying attention, say again, has a foundation, and you can start to see how we tend to confusion or lack of clarity, or the mind drifting, or the self-image coming up. Because this morning talking with Robert and Robert asking a very good question around, you know, how do you maintain mindfulness and awareness, say when you're in conversation or engaging with the world around one. Because it's very easy to, in speech and conversation and engaging with other people, you get drawn into the either the excitement of the conversation or the reaction that one's having or the sort of the propping up of a self-image that one is working from or functioning from. And how do you see, and you, you maybe after you sort of see this, this is sort of really, you know, delusion functioning, and but how do you notice that? How do you recognize that when you're actually engaging in conversation? Because it calls on the mind very, very strongly, very quickly. And I say, my response immediately is, well, you have to, using the body as the anchor. Because usually we use our mind as the anchor. And the mind is very very untrustworthy. It just starts spinning out very quickly. And it's really important to come back into the body when so engaging in conversation, engaging in interacting with people, that one comes back. And one thinks that that you know, by say like by you know paying attention closely to one's mental reactions and really focusing in on it, that it should produce some clarity. It rarely does, because again you're sort of using the mind when the mind's starting to spin out, using the mind to try to it sort of piggybacks onto that and just keeps going. So it's helpful to come back into something that is settling. So that paying attention to the body, paying attention to the feeling of, say, just the breathing, which isn't, you know, you don't, in the middle of a conversation, you don't close your eyes and sort of go into the breath. But I mean, just shifting focus back into the body so that one's starting to become attentive and seeing, feeling what one's doing, being more present of sort of the whole picture. And that's where this sense of clear comprehension starts to come in. You start to get a whole, trying to get a bigger picture of what mindfulness is, what engagement is, what how we're reacting, because it's personalized so quickly. And just sort of seeing, oh, that's a reaction. You can see it. You're feeling it in the body rather than having this. Because usually what happens is this sort of, you know, the play-by-play commentary going on all the time, right? It can be amusing sometimes, but not very helpful. So that, you know, really coming back to the body. So this sense of mindfulness and clear comprehension, seeing how the application of mindfulness is really a, and this works both in terms of one's engaging with the world around one, and also in the meditation. It's really important not to spend enormous amount of time trying to fix the mind too much. This sense of mindfulness and clear comprehension, also in the meditation, starting to see how things, the trains of thought, the habits, the conditioning in the mind are functioning, are working, so that there's an insight into letting go. That it really fosters that in a natural way. So anyway, these are a few thoughts. Plant some seeds for reflection. I'll offer them this evening to you. If there's any questions, I'm happy to.
Monastery a few weeks ago, I came in at the end of a conversation about the monastic. And I was somehow thinking about that as you were talking and wondering what kind of clear comprehensions came from that, doing that. You know, there's the ideal going on alms round to the community, but what kind of comprehensions came from doing that?
Well, I mean, certainly it's something that we've been wanting to do as a, you know, sort of planting the seeds of this monastic tradition in America, and part of it is we're sort of alms mendicants. And going into Ukiah, it's certainly not Northeast Thailand, and going alms round. I mean, there's whole realm. I mean, it's a very good practice both for the monastics as well as the lay people, and particularly for us. I feel it's a really important way of presenting the image of a religious seeker, and on that level, it's a gift. So it's a form of giving for us to give the, because you reflect back on the what were the things that stimulated the Buddha to leave the palace and live the life of spiritual practice. It was the sight of the old person, sick person, dead person, and a religious seeker. So that having the image of a religious seeker in a society is very important. Most Western societies and cultures have been bereft of those images for some time. So it's a gift to bring that image back into the culture. For ourselves, it's a real reminder of our vulnerability, of being completely dependent on the generosity of other people. Because you go in to on alms round, and you're not allowed to actually ask. You make yourself available to the generosity of other people. And you make yourself available to both to tremendous, because some people, the other day we went in, because we go once a week, and on the observance days, the lunar observance days, and there was a car pulled over. Could we walk down the main street? We'd walk up the main street, State Street, and then sort of loop around and come back. And this car pulled over, and it was a little girl, probably about 11 or 12, and her mother. And they jumped out, and they're from City 10,000 Buddhas. And the kind of joy on this little girl's face to see monks and then to put something in the bowl was a real treat to see. And then we continued. They put didn't have anything in the car probably except leftover Halloween candy. So we got sort of some of these little Hershey bars and some other sort of candy type things. And They were in our bowls, and it was funny. The next place we went into further up was a bakery that invites us to come in and receive food. And the woman in the bakery, I opened my bowl and she was going to put this, and she looked in and said, "Wow, that's not good for your teeth." I said, "Well, we don't have much choice. We have to take what we can." But we looped around, and then this car pulled up again. It pulled up at a stoplight, and the girl and the mother leaped out of the car again and had some fruit and some buns and some drinks and whatnot, and put them in our bowl. Really overjoyed to give, and there's a couple cars backed up behind because she just stopped at a red light and got out and emptied the car. Just so excited to be able to put food in the bowl. It's a real treat to see that, and to on the other spectrum, the other end of the spectrum is people sort of yelling abuse at you and whatnot, which. The vulnerability draws all of that, and you just have to be ready to accept that. Although it's interesting that there's, as we continue to go, the positive response is just far outweighs any negative response. So that's quite lovely to see. Some months ago, the local newspaper, I guess 2 or 3 months ago, the local newspaper did a front page article, big picture, and on just monks going alms round in Ukiah, and it was very positive. And then several days later, there was a editorial, and they mentioned it and sort of saying that they didn't and couldn't put in all the letters, which were virtually all a positive response. And it was interesting. And they were commenting, the editor was commenting how that there was this positive response to the article, and also that the good fortune of Ukiah, which is just a middle-sized town, to actually have two Buddhist monasteries, a city of 10,000 Buddhists is there, and. And they also made this neat sort of little contrast of the at the time it was about the time when that television program Survivors was winding up, and they're sort of saying how lovely it is to sort of see something, people who are willing to be content with little and rely on generosity and live simply rather than this tremendous desire to get $1 million or whatever. it was a very positive response in the local papers. There's a whole range of reflections that come up in alms round. One of the things that I tend to do when I'm walking alms round is just to chant the loving kindness sutra. That's what I'm doing. Is rather than going out and looking for food, I'm I'm there generating loving kindness and giving people the opportunity, if they're interested in receiving loving kindness, they can have it. but that's what I see as my opportunity and something to do, to give. So that, you know, that, and that sense of the reciprocal relationship between the monastic community and the lay community becomes very, very clear. And alms round is sort of the very clear sort of example of that. Yes, Sarah. And the Buddha mind. There, I guess it's a bit difficult for me to define or express. In the sense that we say in the Theravada tradition, you usually don't use that phrase, say the Buddha mind. It's a what one's looking at. You know, well, how are you defining the Buddha mind, or what are you thinking of in terms of the Buddha mind? I mean, the heart of enlightenment. Or the Buddha as refuge is maybe one way to look at it. Certainly, when we do the recollection of the Buddha, you're paying attention to the qualities. You know, what are the qualities of the Buddha? Say like Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Those are referring to the qualities of. Wisdom, purity, compassion. Those are the sort of the essence of the heart of the Buddha, the mind, the enlightened mind. So that, say, mindfulness and clear comprehension should be inclining the heart towards those qualities of wisdom, compassion, purity. How do we incline the heart in that direction? How do we implement that? How do we live by that? How do we open the heart to, say, allowing ourselves to be in the presence of wisdom, compassion, and purity, you know, without getting in the way? You know, so, it's very important to recognize that we're not so much trying to make ourselves be wise and compassionate and pure, but we're trying to get out of the way so that we can allow that those qualities to manifest, which are the natural response to seeing things clearly. So that the mindfulness and clear comprehension is giving us the opportunity to see things clearly. And then the response would, if we're really seeing clearly, then the response would be, say, the heart of the Buddha, wisdom, compassion, purity. Does that make sense? Get past the point of pain, or past the point of being fed up with meditation?
The second.
The second, okay. Well, one was just sort of changing my idea of what I thought meditation was because I thought meditation was sitting. And that I had to get this sort of sitting meditation down. So I shifted and started doing a lot of walking meditation and standing meditation. So that was very, very helpful to realize that I didn't have to sit with painful knees and a sore back. And I could still be meditating and developing mindfulness and clear comprehension, doing, say, like walking meditation. Because it plays a big, in the forest tradition, there's a big emphasis placed on all our monasteries will have, each dwelling place will have one's own walking meditation path, which you're encouraged to use. I remember one time Ajahn Chah really fiercely berating the monks and really scolding people for not practicing, and his image or his what he was referring to is, so you say, you know, people are, you can really tell when people are not practicing, and when you can, people are really not diligent in their practice anymore. When you could go walk around the dwelling places and the walking paths are, there's no tracks of human beings on them. All you can see is dog tracks. You can't see any human tracks at all. It's just absolutely disgusting. When the monks aren't doing their walking meditation diligently anymore, then it's like the religion is completely degenerated. So I mean, there was a big premium and encouragement to incorporate walking meditation, use walking meditation as well. And it's a very good balance for both in terms of posture as well in terms of the mental balance. The sitting meditation tends to be more focused. I mean, it lends itself to more concentration. The walking meditation lends itself a bit more to the reflective quality. And it's also in the mindfulness in action training is part of it. So it's very helpful. And then one can adjust it accordingly to one's preference. There's, as I said, during that time when I was, you know, got fed up with sitting meditation because I'd been sort of pushing against pain so much that I just started doing a whole lot more walking meditation. There's one of the sort of great Thai forest masters in the northeast of Thailand. He's been dead many years now, but his daily routine that he would set for himself would be, he would, after the meal in the morning, he'd eat the meal fairly early in Thailand, and he'd, after finishing the meal, then he'd do 3 hours of walking meditation. And then he'd have a bit of a rest around midday, and then he'd do 3 hours of walking meditation, and then he'd have a bath and have some tea, and then he'd do 3 hours of walking meditation, and then he'd start sitting. Just sort of warm up to the sitting a bit. know, so some teachers and some practitioners have used walking meditation really as the main vehicle for practice. You know, our image is usually around, you know, sitting meditation. If I were a really good meditator, I'd be able to, you know, sit in full lotus and straight all the time. One of the well, it's very interesting in terms of, say, the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha didn't really talk about, say, what is the perfect political solution for all the world's problems. He taught, say, when he was in the company of kings, in a sort of an absolute monarchy, then he taught those kings or those monarchs what were their, say, what were the duties of a responsible king. When he was, and India was in had various states, and many of them were monarchies, and a couple of them were republics. And in those when he lived in the republics, then he taught what would be a good functioning republic. So that he wasn't really fixed on a political system, but sort of what are the responsibilities? What are the responsibilities of a leader? What are the responsibilities of a subject? What are the responsibilities of a person involved in the process? So that you know, we've got for better or worse, we have a republic here, and you know, one of the responsibilities is in a republic is actually being engaged in the process for it to work, so that for myself, living in a monastery, I actually didn't talk about the election tonight because I really don't know what's happening, and living at a Bhayagiri, I actually get less news and less knowledge of what's going on in the country and the world than I would in Thailand. Which is great. but I really don't know the issues, and also, not being an American, I don't really have much. I don't have much investment in it, so that there isn't the emotional pull toward it. So I really don't know that much about it. But the you know, certainly in terms of as I say, so when the Buddha talked about these different political systems, then part of a functioning republic is the involvement and engage in engaging in the political process, you know, to whatever extent is feasible. So that I think certainly the and there's not much motivation to be involved in the process. I mean, that's one of the problems, is sort of the dysfunctional sort of system that we're inheriting in this age. There just isn't that much motivation, which is unfortunate. It's been several decades now, and the president of the United States is usually elected from a sector within the population. 40 to 45% of the population actually votes. You have the president of the most powerful country in the world being elected by maybe 20 or 25% of the people. Something's not adding up here. It's scary. So that's and I don't know. I really don't know what to. What are solutions? Certainly, I think, and like being trying to get involved in local politics is, I think, really useful sometimes. The actual on a community level, it gives some sort of a foundation of at least starting somewhere. I think that'd be really useful. Because there is such a sense, a feeling of, we don't really have much. My vote doesn't really count, and it's not much, doesn't have much effect. I think it's quite important to actually motivate ourselves in some way to be involved, because the process doesn't actually work without involvement. Okay, it's after 9:30. It's about appropriate for the evening. We can pay our homage to the Triple Gem. Dharma.
blessed ones, disciples, who have practiced well.